themselves throughout her body, perhaps for life, and she may bequeath some of her cells to the child. This is not merely a thought experiment. In 2009, researchers at Harvard did a study on 11 surrogate mothers who carried boys but who never had sons of their own. After the women gave birth, the scientists found Y chromosomes in the bloodstreams of 5 of them. Fishbach and Loik don't argue that surrogacy should be banned because of chimerism, but they do think that surrogates-to-be need to give informed consent that's truly informed. It may come as a surprise to them that their own DNA could have a long-term influence on the health of an unrelated child, and that they may end up with some of the child's cells, complete with a separate genome. These women need to know that heredity's tendrils can't be pruned as easily as we might imagine. The Tasmanian devil couldn't have been dead long. Elizabeth Murchison got out of her car in a cool, damp gully. It was the summer of 2006, and Murchison had just spent a week hiking the central highlands of Tasmania. Now she appreciated the shady break from the heat. She noticed a cloud of flies swirling over a black creature the size of a Jack Russell Terrier. A wound on its neck was still trickling blood, presumably from a recent collision with some vehicle. Murchison turned over its body, hoping to see something. And there it was, a pea-sized lump of pink flesh swelling from its face. Murchison had grown up in Tasmania, listening to the howls of devils in the night. When it came time for college, she headed to mainland Australia to study genetics, and in 2002 she traveled to Cold Spring Harbor in New York to earn her Ph.D. Murchison studied microRNAs, molecules made by our cells to silence genes when needed. Not surprisingly, she was the only Tasmanian in Cold Spring Harbor, and so she often found herself answering questions about Tasmanian devils. She would explain how the real animals were nothing like the Looney Tunes version, the drooling cartoon tornado that swept across American television screens. Tasmanian devils were actually the largest living species of marsupial predators, and a tough species at that. They have a habit of biting off pieces of each other's faces, whether in a fight over food or a courtship. Tough as they might be, though, Tasmanian devils were in trouble. A singular epidemic was sweeping across the island, not quite like anything veterinarians had seen before. A devil would develop a fleshy growth in or around its mouth. In a matter of weeks, the growth would balloon, and within a few months, the animal would starve or suffocate. These growths were first observed in 1996 in the northeast corner of Tasmania, and over the next few years they spread over most of the island, killing off tens of thousands of devils. By the early 2000s, the species looked like it might become extinct in a matter of decades, killed by a disease scientists didn't understand. It would take them years to realize that these devils were chimeras, and that their cancers descended from the cells of a long-dead animal. Murchison and her fellow graduate students would try to guess at the diagnosis for the devils. On an individual animal, the disease looked like a tumor, hence its name, devil facial tumor disease. But as Bovary first recognized, a typical tumor is a mosaic. It arises from an animal's own body, thanks to a series of mutations that pile up along a lineage of cells. The reports of new devil facial tumor cases formed a wave-like pattern, as if they were a contagious epidemic. Some of Murchison's colleagues guessed a virus was to blame. Some viruses do cause cancer by infecting cells and disrupting their biochemistry, but once a virus infects its host, it can take years to produce cancer. Devil facial tumor disease was moving far faster. An even bigger problem with the virus hypothesis arose when scientists closely examined the tumors themselves. The tumor cells were not mosaics, descended from a devil's own zygote. They had an entirely different pattern of bands in their chromosomes, indicating that they came from a different animal altogether. The devils were actually chimeras. Soon afterward, an Australian geneticist named Kathy Beloff led a more detailed study on the disease. She and her colleagues sequenced microsatellites from tumors and healthy tissues taken from a number of devils. The DNA fingerprint from tumor cells didn't match the healthy cells from the same devil's body. Instead, they matched cancer cells from devils who died dozens of miles away. It was as if all the sick devils had gotten a cancer transplant from a single tumor. When Murchison encountered the roadkill devil in the Tasmanian forests, she decided then and there she would study the tumors. At the time, powerful new technologies for reading genomes were just becoming affordable enough for small groups of scientists to use. In 2009, Murchison brought samples from the roadkill devil to the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute in England to read its DNA more closely than anyone had read the tumor DNA before. The genome in the tumors had undergone many changes, but Murchison could trace back its history through earlier generations. She found a pair of X chromosomes in the cells, and no trace of a Y chromosome, so the cancer must have begun in a female devil. Murchison then looked for clues about which kind of cell it started out as. She sequenced the microRNAs from tumor cells. The cells were making a combination of molecules typically only found in one kind of cell. It's a type of nerve known as a Schwann cell, which normally wraps an insulating sleeve around other neurons to help them send their signals. At some point in the early 90s, Murchison's research showed, a single Tasmanian devil in the northeast corner of the island got cancer. The mutations may have initially arisen in a Schwann cell. The descendants of that original cancer cell grew into a tumor. During a fight, another devil bit off the tumor. The cancer cells did not end up digested in the attacker's stomach. Instead, they likely lingered in the devil's mouth, where they were able to burrow into the cheek lining and work their way metastatically into the other tissues in the devil's head. The cancer cells continued dividing and mutating until they broke through the skin of the second devil's face. At some point, that new victim also got bit, and its own attacker took in the cells from the original cancer. A single carrier could pass the cancer on to several other devils if it was especially aggressive, and thus help accelerate its spread. Passing through host after host, the tumor cells gained about 20,000 new mutations. As strange as it had become, the devil's contagious cancer has not escaped the bonds of heredity. All the tumors that grew in thousands of Tasmanian devils were united along an unbroken line to their female Schwann cell ancestor. But the conventional language we use to describe heredity fails to describe what is happening in Tasmania. August Weismann had crystallized our conception of heredity by giving germ cells a chance for immortality. Now a batch of somatic cells from a mammal had gained an immortality of its own by moving out of its original body and ending up in new ones. The original cancerous Schwann cell died inside a Tasmanian devil decades ago, as did the subsequent victims of its cancer. But the tumors endured because they were in the right place for another Tasmanian devil to bite off a chunk of them and let them live on in a new home. Murchison's research showed just how cobbled together heredity is. It's not a cosmic imperative, but a process that emerged from biological ingredients and has been modified into new forms. And yet, on their own, devil facial tumors might have ended up as little more than a philosophical curiosity. It was easy to dismiss them as the product of a weird species restricted to a remote corner of the world. In fact, contagious cancers were cosmopolitan, spanning the planet. Murchison knew that there was at least one other form of contagious cancer, a disease in dogs known as canine transmissible venereal tumor, CTVT for short. It's a particularly ugly disease, causing oozing tumors to grow around the genitals. The disease is found in many countries and is most common in stray dogs. Because it's disgustingly obvious, pet owners quickly take their animals to the vet for treatment. While devil facial tumors only came to light in the 1990s, the symptoms of CTVT were already known by 1810. In a book called A Domestic Treatise on the Diseases of Horses and Dogs, the British veterinarian Delabere Blaine described a fungus excrescence that formed around the genitals of dogs. At the time, some physicians believed the growths were caused by bad humors, while others thought they spread like the plague. It wasn't until 1876 that a Russian veterinarian named Mstislav Novinsky carried out the first successful transplant of the cancer. He cut pieces of a canine-transmissible venereal tumor from a sick dog and inserted them in the skin of two puppies. After a month, each puppy had a tumor of its own. Novinsky then cut off a piece of one of the new tumors and grafted it to another dog. The second-generation tumor grew as well. Later generations of scientists carried out more detailed versions of Novinsky's experiment. In 1934, a veterinarian and a pathologist reported carrying the cancer forward through 11 dogs, but they could succeed only when they used living cancer cells. Dead cells wouldn't do the trick, nor the fluid from tumors. In a few cases, the cancer became metastatic and killed the dogs, but most of the time it grew for a few months before disappearing. The origin of the cells forming this tumor is unknown, the researchers wrote. They suspected that sometimes dogs could spontaneously develop the cancer and then pass it to other dogs through mating. Cancer biologists paid CTVT little mind because it didn't work like standard cancer, which is caused either by random mutations or by certain viruses. But the discovery of contagious cancers in Tasmanian devils led a number of scientists to take another look. In 2006, a British biologist named Robin Weiss and his colleagues collected CTVT tumors from 40 dogs on 5 continents. They sequenced short pieces of DNA from each one, along with healthy cells from other parts of the dogs. Weiss and his colleagues found that the dogs were also chimeras, not mosaics. All the cancer cells shared a common set of genetic variants, variants that couldn't be found in the healthy cells in any of the dogs. Rather than cropping up from time to time in different dogs, the scientists realized, the disease had arisen just once. Murchison followed up on Weiss's study with one of her own. Instead of looking at snippets of DNA, she and her colleagues sequenced the entire genomes of 2 tumor cells. One came from a Cocker Spaniel in Brazil, and the other from an Aboriginal camp dog in Australia. Each tumor cell had just over 100,000 unique mutations not shared by the other one. But the 2 cells shared 1.9 million mutations in common that Murchison didn't find in ordinary dog DNA. The cancer cells still carry clues about their origins. Murchison suspects that they descend from some kind of immune cells, based on the genes they use and the ones they keep quiet. That signature may be a distant echo from the origin of CTVT, an immune cell in an ancient dog turned cancerous, and eventually the cancer found a way to other dogs. Murchison and her colleagues also discovered that CTVT is far, far older than devil facial tumor. Mutations accumulate in cancer cells at a roughly clock-like rate. Based on the mutations in different CTVT cells, Murchison and her colleagues estimated that the cancer arose in a single dog about 11,000 years ago, around the end of the Ice Age. If it had been an ordinary tumor, CTVT might have endured for a few years until its host died. Instead, it escaped mortality's trap and endured 1,000 times longer than a typical dog. In different parts of the world, the tumor cells acquired new mutations that they passed on to their descendants. Those mutations sketched out a map of the tumor's journey. It began somewhere in the Old World, when Europeans brought dogs on ships to new continents like Australia and North America. They brought CTVT with them. While devil facial tumor may be limited to a corner of the world, humans have spread CTVT everywhere they brought their dogs. 2 cases of contagious cancer would have been extraordinary enough, but as Murchison was studying dogs and devils, another case came to light, not on land, but in the sea. In the 1960s, marine biologists discovered a leukemia-like cancer in some species of clams. Their immune cells multiplied explosively, invading all of the animal's tissues. It typically took just a few weeks for the cancer to claim a clam's life. The biologists have never seen anything quite like the cancer before. What made it especially baffling was how quickly new cases turned up. Once one clam in a population got sick, it didn't take long before almost all the animals died. This cancer roared up the East Coast until, by the 2000s, it was killing soft-shell clams from New York all the way north to Prince Edward Island in Canada. 2 biologists at Columbia University, Stephen Goff and Michael Metzger, studied the clams to see if a virus was triggering them to form tumors. They found no sign of cancer-causing viruses. And when Metzger and his colleagues looked at DNA from the cancer cells, they were flummoxed to find that the cells in different clams shared a common set of genetic markers. It looked as if the scientists had stumbled across a third contagious cancer. To test this idea, Metzger brought clams into Goff's lab and put them into tanks. If he put a healthy clam in a tank with a cancerous one, it became cancerous too. Surveying cancer cells from along the east coast of North America, Metzger could find mutations in some of them and not others, allowing him to draw a genealogical tree. Some long-ago clam had developed leukemia, Metzger and Goff concluded, and it expelled some of its cancer cells into the ocean currents. As nearby clams filtered seawater for bits of food, they also sucked in the cancer. Over the years, the outbreak had hopscotched its way hundreds of miles from its origin. Metzger and his colleagues knew that marine biologists had been finding fast-spreading cancers in some other species of clams, as well as other bivalves. In all these cases, scientists had tried to find a cancer-causing virus and had come up empty-handed. Metzger got in touch with colleagues around the world and was able to get hold of three sickened species to study: mussels, cockles, and golden carpet shell clams. All three of their cancers also turned out to be contagious. The cockles proved to have not one strain of contagious cancer, but two, and the cancer in the golden carpet shell clams had particularly weird DNA. It didn't start out as a golden carpet shell clam. Instead, it came from pullet shell clams, another species that lives in the same intertidal beds off the coast of Spain as the golden carpet shell clam. That discovery led the scientists to inspect pullet shell clams, but they failed to find any of the cancer cells in them. They concluded that a strain of contagious cancer must have started in pullet shell clams and then jumped species, infecting golden carpet shell clams. It killed off all the vulnerable pullet shell clams, leaving only resistant ones behind. Meanwhile, back in Tasmania, biologists were busy trying to protect the devils from extinction. They built colonies of healthy animals at zoos and turned a small island off the coast of Tasmania into a refuge. If the devil facial tumor did kill off all the wild devils of Tasmania, the protected animals could be brought back. But in March 2014, a University of Tasmania graduate student named Ruth Pye made an ominous discovery. She was analyzing cancer cells from a devil caught south of the city of Hobart and found something in them that shouldn't have been there, a Y chromosome. Murchison and her colleagues had already established that the progenitor of the disease had been a female devil. Pye's new cancer looked as if it had started in a male. A close examination of its entire genome revealed a wealth of unique mutations not found in any of the other tumors. The data pointed to an inescapable conclusion. Pye had discovered a second devil facial tumor. Later, she and her colleagues found another seven sick devils in the region with the same form. They dubbed the two lines of contagious cancer DFT1 and DFT2. While DFT1 arose around 1990, DFT2 has fewer mutations of its own, suggesting it emerged more recently. It's a worrying finding because it means that the process by which contagious cancers emerge in devils may be more common than previously thought. If conservation biologists manage to save the devils from DFT1 and DFT2, who's to say they won't face DFT3 before long? From the cancers identified so far, scientists can start developing hypotheses for how they emerge and manage to break heredity's rules. It looks as if the ability to become a contagious cancer is not limited to one particular type of cell. It just has to start down the road to cancer. One of the biggest challenges to a developing tumor is the immune system, which continually patrols the body for suspicious-looking cells. Cancer cells can evolve a range of tricks to evade detection. They can cut back on their production of surface proteins such as HLA that immune cells recognize in order to tell good cells from bad, for example. No one knows yet what sort of adaptations cancer cells need to survive the first journey from one host to another. Perhaps it all comes down to an accidental mutation that keeps them from desiccating in the dry air. Once they've made the first jump, their immune evasions become even more valuable because now they are clearly foreigners rather than traitors from within. And once the contagious cancer cells move into a new host, some of the adaptations they gained in their normal existence as a tumor may turn out to help them once more. They can send out signals to the surrounding tissue, hypnotizing cells into helping them get nourishment. Contagious cancer is not all that different from an ordinary tumor that becomes metastatic and spreads from one organ to another. The new organ is, in effect, another animal. But unlike ordinary tumors, contagious cancers no longer face an inescapable death. Instead of gaining a few years' worth of mutations, they can gain centuries of them. After 11,000 years circulating among dogs, for example, CTVT has acquired an impressive arsenal of mutations in genes linked to immune surveillance. And just like ordinary cancer cells, CTVT cells have stolen mitochondria to replace their own. The only difference is that they steal mitochondria from a series of dogs, at least five different dogs over the past 2,000 years. From the days of the Roman Empire onward, CTVT has recharged itself like a vampire with the youth of its canine victims. Contagious cancers were a scientific secret hiding in plain sight for 2 centuries. Once scientists realized what they were and started to wonder if there were others, they started finding more. It's almost certain that the 8 cases identified so far are not the last. No one knows just how many there will be. It's possible that some species will prove to be more prone to them than others. The small population of Tasmanian devils may make them vulnerable because they have a low level of genetic diversity. In such a species, it's easier for a contagious cancer to hide inside new hosts because it doesn't look so suspiciously foreign. Contagious cancers also need an easy route from one host to the next. Dogs have long bouts of sex that can last half an hour and leave them with broken skin. That's a promising route for a tumor adapted to growing around the genitals. But we shouldn't underestimate the lengths that contagious cancer cells can go to in order to get into new hosts. After all, now we know they can swim. Indeed, even if scientists come across more cases of contagious cancers, the true rate may be far higher. Perhaps, like gene drives, contagious cancers are regularly emerging from animals, only to disappear, either because the immune systems of their hosts evolve a potent defense, or because they drive their hosts to extinction. All of which raises the disturbing question, could we humans develop a plague of contagious cancer? I'm not talking about an epidemic of cancer-causing viruses such as HPV, which can cause cervical cancer. I'm talking about human cells taking up residence in other humans, tumors that travel across the social planet. The scientific literature is sprinkled with intriguing cases of cancer cells moving from one person to another. A transplanted kidney turned out to contain a tumor. A surgeon accidentally nicked his hand, allowing his patient's skin cancer to slip into his body. A few pregnant women with leukemia passed some of their cancerous immune cells to their fetuses. In an exceptionally bizarre case, a man in Medellin, Colombia, got infected with a tapeworm from which a cell grew into a tumor-like mass. Yet all of these cases only document cancer making a single leap. There's no evidence of the same lineage of cancer cells moving on to a third victim. It may be that our immune systems are so strong that cancers never get the chance to evolve into parasites that can leap from host to host. Why our immune systems should react so violently to foreign tissue is puzzling. For the most part, our immune system is exquisitely adapted to particular threats. Our cells can sense invading viruses and commit suicide to stop their infection. We can make antibodies to destroy a strain of bad bacteria while sparing our beneficial bugs. These are the products of evolution, which gave our ancestors better odds of surviving and reproducing. But our ancestors were not constantly transplanting lungs and spleens into each other. So why should our immune system be so well prepared to respond? One way to make sense of this enigma is the risk of contagious cancers. Perhaps our early animal ancestors, 700 million years ago, regularly faced invasions of parasitic offshoots of other animals. They had to fight off the heredities of others, or die and lose their own. Part 4. Other Channels. Chapter 14. You, my friend, are a wonderland. When the dark of moonless nights arrives, the one-fin flashlight fish emerges from its hiding place. This fish, scientifically known as Photoblepharon palpebratus, lives in the waters off the Banda Islands, a scattered archipelago in Indonesia. It spends the daylight hours resting in caves 100 feet or more underwater. When the sea turns black, the fish swims out of its caves, up to the surface waters. As it hunts for little invertebrates, its body emits a cream-colored light. Like any animal, the flashlight fish is actually a collection of organs. Its skin acts as a barrier, protecting it from the surrounding sea. Its gills draw oxygen. Its stomach digests its prey. Each organ is distinct, because its cells produce a distinctive collection of molecules and operate a distinctive network of genes. The light made by the fish comes from a pair of jelly bean-shaped structures under each eye. To produce their light, the cells in those jelly beans manufacture proteins that glow. Shining a light might not seem a very smart thing to do when you're a small fish swimming in a sea of predators, but flashlight fish can actually use it to escape their enemies. To flee, they dash straight ahead for a while, their light organs tracing a forward-moving line. They then roll each light organ into a pocket in their head. The fish suddenly go dark and then break away from their straight line, leaving predators barreling forward into empty water. Their light organs thus help the fish survive long enough to reproduce. The males cast sperm into the water to fertilize female eggs, which develop into larvae and finally into mature fish. Like engenders like is as true for flashlight fish as for any other animal. Every new generation developed fins like their ancestors did, along with eyes, jaws, and gills, and light organs. In 1971, a pair of scientists, Yata Haneda of the Yokosuka City Museum and Frederick Tsuji of the University of Pittsburgh, journeyed to the Banda Islands to investigate the one-fin flashlight fish. In the evenings, they would push off from shore in a canoe. Eventually, they would extinguish their lights and gaze into the water, searching for the fish's gleam. When Haneda and Tsuji caught some in a net, they put the animals in jars of seawater and later dissected the light organs. Even after they were carved out of the animals, the organs still glowed. Banda fishermen use the light organ as a lure, putting it on a hook where it can glow for hours. Haneda and Tsuji inspected the light organ cells under a microscope to understand how they worked. It was possible that the fish produced their light like fireflies. Fireflies carry a gene in their DNA for a protein called luciferin. The insects store luciferin in the cells in their tail. When they want to send a signal to their fellow fireflies, they use other proteins to alter the luciferin, unleashing its stored light. Fireflies inherit the luciferin gene from their parents, along with the rest of their genes. But the one-fin flashlight fish has no genes for making light, Haneda and Tsuji discovered. The glowing cells in their light organ do not belong to the fish itself. They are bacteria. They are not just any bacteria, however. If you look in the light organs of any one-fin flashlight fish, the glowing microbes always belong to the same strain, known as Candidatus photodesmus blepharus. And if you want to find Candidatus photodesmus blepharus, the one-fin flashlight fish is the only species on Earth where you'll find it. The same waters around the Banda Islands are also home to a nearly identical species, the two-fin flashlight fish, with its own bacteria-loaded light organ. But the bacteria glowing inside them is different. Each species of flashlight fish inherits its own exquisitely rare microbial partner. All species of animals and plants are shot through with microbes, ourselves included. By one estimate, each human being contains about 37 trillion human cells and about the same number of bacteria. It's easy to ignore our bacterial half, because human cells are hundreds of times bigger than microbes. Yet that's no reason to ignore them. We have thousands of species of bacteria within us, each carrying thousands of its own genes that are fundamentally unlike our own. In this respect, we are no different from any other animal, any Portuguese man of war, any desert scorpion, any elephant seal. We're not even very different from a sugar maple tree or an evening crocus. The bacteria we're most familiar with are those that cause diseases, chewing through our skin and raging through our guts. Yet even in the best of health, we are still rife with permanent lodgers. Some harmlessly cling to their hosts, scavenging molecular scraps. Others perform tasks on which their hosts depend for their survival. If the flashlight fish had no bacteria, it would have no flashlight. Other microbes carry out tasks that are harder to see, but no less important. They synthesize vitamins. They nurture a well-tempered immune system. They form a living barrier against dangerous pathogens. The microbiome, as this collective is known, blurs any simple notion of what it means to be an individual organism. If we turned into true individuals, sterilized of our microbiome, we'd become sick and might well die. In each species, every new generation acquires a microbiome. In some regards, this cycle of renewal looks a lot like heredity. A new animal does not acquire its own genes out of the blue, synthesized from scratch. Its genes have been duplicated over and over again inside the cells of its ancestors, taking an extraordinary journey to get to each new animal. A man, for example, starts off as a zygote full of genes, which are copied each time that fertilized egg divides. The genes end up in totipotent cells, and then in pluripotent cells, and then in cells destined for different tissues. Some of those cells end up as germ cells. As these cells migrate through the body, they bring their genes to the region where the testicles will later develop. Years later, the descendants of these cells may develop into long-tailed sperm, each containing only one copy of each of the man's genes. Although a man makes billions of sperm over the course of his life, Only a tiny fraction of them at most will ever manage to leave his body and enter a woman's reproductive tract, and fewer still will deliver his genes into an egg. The genes of bacteria can take strikingly similar routes of their own through the generations of their hosts. One of the most remarkable of these journeys takes place thousands of feet underwater, where thick beds of vesicomyid clams thrive around cracks in the seafloor. The clams soak up hydrogen sulfide, the toxic chemical that gives rotten eggs their awful smell, rising out of the cracks. They absorb it into their muscles, and then their circulatory system delivers the compound to their gills. Special cells in the gills, cells that don't exist in other species of clams, split sulfur atoms from the hydrogen sulfide molecules, releasing the energy stored in their bonds. The clam uses this energy to combine carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen into sugar molecules. The clams act much like trees, except that they capture a subterranean chemical energy instead of sunlight. To be precise, it's not the clams themselves that seize the seafloor's energy. The specialized cells in their gills are actually bacteria. They carry the gene for an enzyme that can break down hydrogen sulfide. In exchange for this service, the clams supply the bacteria with a well-appointed home. Without those bacteria, the clams would starve. Without the clams, the bacteria would barely eke out an existence. This relationship is remarkable for many reasons, not the least of which is geography. Because vesicomyid clams can grow only where hydrogen sulfide seeps out of the seafloor, clam beds may be miles from each other. The clams broadcast their sex cells into the surrounding water, and after fertilization, the clam larvae drift through the sea. Most of them will land in the marine desert and die. Only a few will end up at a site where they can grow. They bring with them the bacteria they need to survive, as their ancestors did. To understand how the clams manage to hold on to their partners is difficult, because it's nearly impossible to rear a deep-sea creature in the comfort of a laboratory. Instead, scientists haul up clams from the seafloor and pick apart their dead bodies for clues. In 1993, S. Craig Carey and Stephen Giovannoni of Oregon State University mapped the bacteria inside clams by searching for their DNA. They found some in the gill cells that house the microbes, but they also found some bacterial DNA in the ovary-like organs where clam eggs develop. Somehow the bacteria were traveling through the clams from the gills to the eggs, which they could invade in order to get into the next generation. The new clams are born infected, inheriting an expanded set of genes, some animal and some bacterial. It's hard not to wonder what Darwin would have thought of these clams. When he pictured heredity, he saw gemmules streaming from across the body to the germ cells, coming together to carry on the body's traits to the next generation. His theory of pangenesis turned out to be wrong, and biologists set it aside as one of his exceptional blunders. They turned instead to August Weismann's stark division between the germline and the soma. Now researchers are finding that deep-sea clams use a gemmule-like form of heredity to carry their partners into the future. If these deep-sea clams were the only species on Earth to inherit a vital trait this way, it might be possible to dismiss them as an oddity, in the same way it was once possible to dismiss contagious cancers as a Tasmanian fluke. But they have company. Many animals ensure that essential bacteria get inside their eggs, and some of them, like cockroaches, are a lot easier to study than deep-sea clams. Among the microbes that live inside cockroaches is one called Blattobacterium. Just like clams, cockroaches develop special cells inside of which Blattobacterium can dwell. Instead of feeding on chemical-laden seawater, cockroaches graze on organic matter on land, able to survive on what they find on the floor of a forest or a New York apartment. Blattobacterium is essential to their global conquest. As the insects eat, they store away nitrogen in an organ in the cockroach abdomen, called the fat body. Inside the fat body are some cells infected with Blattobacterium. The bacteria convert that nitrogen into amino acids and other building blocks that the cockroach needs to grow. Sometimes the cells housing Blattobacterium will take a trip. They crawl out of the fat body and seek out the cockroach's eggs. They attach themselves to the eggs for a few days before ripping themselves open. Their resident bacteria spill out to be swallowed up by the eggs so that a new generation of cockroaches can continue to conquer the world. These strictly in-house bacteria, known as endosymbionts, did not always live this way. Their ancestors lived outside of hosts. The free-living cousins of endosymbionts have helped researchers learn about how some bacteria have evolved into such intimate partners. In case after case, the microbes took a gradual slide into a life inside. This research shows that when the free-living ancestors of endosymbionts came into contact with a host, be it a roach, a clam, or one of millions of other species, they could grow on it by good fortune or even inside it. By sheer coincidence, these bacteria provided some benefit to their hosts, perhaps casting off a useful amino acid in their waste. If their hosts did well as a result, the bacteria had more opportunity to reproduce in them. Natural selection favored bacteria that can do their hosts more favors because their interests were becoming aligned. Likewise, their hosts evolved to nurture the bacteria. Evolving special cells to shelter the bacteria ensured that animals could enjoy their services. As the bacteria grew ever more pampered, genes that were once essential in the outside world became useless. Mutations that broke these newly superfluous genes no longer guaranteed extinction. The bacteria became genetically streamlined, their genomes shrinking in size by 90% or more. Some endosymbionts have lost the ability to do just about anything except the one thing that their host can't do. Both the bacteria and their animal hosts became trapped in an evolutionary rabbit hole from which there is no escape. Once they were locked in symbiosis, their evolution began to follow identical paths. When an insect species split in two, its endosymbionts split as well. Their evolutionary trees became mirror images, with identical branches splitting from each other for tens of millions of years. The story of the one-fin flashlight fish is a lot like those of the clams and the cockroaches. It also builds a special shelter, the light organ, where its bacteria can thrive. Every new generation of flashlight fish inherits a fresh supply of the same species of bacteria. In effect, the fish are expanding their genomes to include light-producing genes. Those genes just so happen to belong to a separate species. As the bacteria have adapted to life inside light organs, they have lost 80% of their genome. There is one important difference, however. A female flashlight fish does not carefully move bacteria inside her body, transferring them from her light organ into her eggs. Her offspring hatch from their eggs lacking the microbes they need to glow. To gain their own flashlight, they have to get infected. Each day, as an adult one-fin flashlight fish hunkers down in a cave, it sheds some of its bacteria. While Candidatus photodesmus blepharus has lost most of the genes required to live outside an animal, it still clings to a few. Some of the genes enable it to build tails it can whip back and forth to swim through the sea. It also still retains genes for making chemical sensing proteins, which it likely uses as a molecular nose, sniffing its way to young flashlight fish that it can invade. Ultimately, though, it's up to the fish to let the bacteria into their light organ. They've got a strict admission policy. The same waters also teem with the bacteria that give light to the two-fin flashlight fish, but those microbes can't get in. This pattern of heredity is looser than the strict transmission of bacteria in clams and cockroaches, and yet it still embodies some of heredity's essential features. In the journey from one generation to the next, the bacteria and their genes aren't neatly bundled together with the host's genes in an egg, but the outcome is the same. A combined genome continues to produce a cream-colored light in the Banda Sea in each new generation, as it has for millions of years. Our own microbiome is yet another step away from standard heredity. We don't develop a special pouch that exists only to be packed with one species of bacteria. If you give antibiotics to a vesicomyid clam and destroy its sulfur-feeding bacteria, it will die. But there's no single species of bacteria upon which our own life depends. In fact, there's not even a single species of bacteria that we humans all share. We house personalized zoos. I got an intimate appreciation for our variety a few years ago when I went to a science conference. Wandering from talk to talk, I encountered a biologist named Rob Dunn who waved a Q-tip in front of me. He asked if I'd give him a sample from my belly button for a survey he was carrying out. I'm the sort of person who says yes to such requests without missing a beat, and so within a few minutes I was in the nearest men's room, knocking out lint from my navel and swiping it with Dunn's Q-tip, which I dropped into a plastic vial of alcohol. Dunn and his colleagues collected hundreds of these vials and extracted DNA fragments out of each of them. Most of those fragments were obviously human, but some belonged to bacteria. Dunn and his colleagues searched for matching sequences in online databases to figure out which species they came from. In my belly button, they found 53 species of bacteria. When Dunn sent me a spreadsheet with my personal naval catalog, he added a message. You, my friend, are a wonderland. Having 53 species of bacteria in one's navel is nothing special, I should point out. Dunn and his colleagues have found twice as many in some other people. To get an overall sense of this diversity, the scientists analyzed results from 60 people. All told, they identified 2,368 species. None was present in every person. 8 species were present in at least 70% of Dunn's subjects, but 92% could be found only in 10% or less of the subjects. The majority was found only in a single person. When I looked over my spreadsheet, I could see that 17 of my species were unique to me. One type, called Maramonis, had only been known from the Mariana Trench, the deepest spot in the ocean. Another, called Georginia, lives in the soil, in Japan. On discovering this, I emailed Dunn to let him know I'd never been to Japan. It has apparently been to you, he replied. The weirdness of my spreadsheet stems from our profound ignorance of the microbial world. Microbes are unimaginably diverse, with thousands of species in a single spoonful of soil. Although microbiologists have been naming species of bacteria for well over a century, they've described only a tiny fraction of the Earth's single-celled diversity. Maramonis was named for a deep-sea microbe, but the lineage likely includes many other species adapted to other environments, including human skin. Within the howling complexity of the human microbiome, however, you can still hear heredity's signal. It begins when a mother seeds her children's microbiome. When this seeding starts is still not clear. Although researchers have long held that embryos start off sterile in a bacteria-free amniotic sac, a few studies have hinted that at least some maternal bacteria may slip into the fetal sanctuary. What is abundantly clear, however, is that once a baby starts moving down through the birth canal, it gets contaminated. The bacteria growing on the canal walls slather the baby in a microbial coat. Some of the bacteria grow across its skin, while some slip into the mouth and make their way to the gut. A nursing mother can inoculate her baby with even more bacteria. Breasts foster microbes, which they allow to mix into their milk. Small-scale studies suggest that the strains that move most successfully through nursing into the babies are especially good at breaking down milk sugar and converting compounds in milk into vitamins that babies need. Mothers appear to play favorites, promoting certain species of bacteria in their babies and filtering out others. While breast milk contains a lot of nutrients that a baby can absorb, it also contains certain sugars, called oligosaccharides, which are indigestible. Indigestible by humans, to be specific. Certain strains of gut bacteria delight in oligosaccharides, multiplying in the guts of nursing infants. Mothers may thus transmit microbes to future generations in a heredity-like way. To see how closely our microbes have followed us through the generations, a University of Texas microbiologist named Howard Ackman and his colleagues looked far back in evolutionary time. They compared the microbiomes of humans and those that live in our closest primate relatives, gorillas, chimpanzees, and bonobos. Bonobos are a species of ape that split from the ancestors of chimpanzees about 2 million years ago. They found that many lineages of bacteria that live in the human gut do not exist in the guts of our fellow apes. Instead, those apes have their own related strains of bacteria. When Ackman and his colleagues compared the evolutionary trees of the hosts and the bacteria, they lined up closely, branching in the same patterns. Microbes in chimpanzees tend to be more closely related to ours than those that live in gorillas, just as chimpanzees themselves are our closest kin. Ackman's study suggests that for more than 15 million years, our ancestors have been in a tight coevolutionary dance with their microbiome. As hominins split off from other apes, they adapted to new kinds of diets, and their microbes may have adapted as well. Our ancestors evolved ways to foster only the strains of bacteria that belonged to us and not to other species. The oligosaccharides in human milk are different from those in the milk of other mammals. They may be adapted to foster some of our own strains of bacteria, shutting out others that can grow in other species. In a few cases, bacteria get passed down so loyally from human parents to children that they can serve as rough genealogical records. A species known as Helicobacter pylori adapted long ago to life in the human stomach. Impervious to the digestive juices we make, it guzzles glucose in the food we eat. How a microbe can get from one human stomach into another is a mystery, but epidemiological studies show that infections with H. pylori start early in childhood. The bacteria have been found in the plaque on people's teeth, carried there by refluxes into their mouths. It's possible that mothers and other family members infect babies by transmitting the bacteria from their mouths to the children. Whatever route H. pylori takes, it's a tremendously successful one. By some estimates, it lives in the stomachs of over half the people on Earth. Before the advent of antibiotics, that figure might have been closer to 100%. A small fraction of people who carry the bacteria will go on to develop ulcers and gastric cancer, but H. pylori is, for the most part, our friend. It sends signals to the developing immune system in children, helping it learn how to respond carefully to threats rather than overreacting and harming our own bodies. In billions of people's stomachs, the microbe grows and divides. The mutations that it accumulates along the way have allowed scientists to draw an evolutionary tree of the bacteria. The history recorded in its branches bears a striking resemblance to the history of our own species. H. pylori first colonized humans in Africa more than 100,000 years ago, and people carried it around the world with them. If you want to know something about your ancestry, you can look at your own genes, but you can also get some clues from the H. pylori that you inherited from your ancestors. Children do not inherit all their microbes only from their mothers, or even just their families. They can pick up bacteria from friends' toys they stick in their mouths, from teachers who wipe the dirt off their cheeks, even from the air they breathe. Yet even the bacteria that move freely from stranger to stranger also become intertwined with our own heredity. To see this intertwining, you first have to think about our microbiomes as a heritable trait, just like our height, intelligence, and risk of getting a heart attack. And you have to study it as such. Julia Goodrich, a microbiologist at Cornell University, and her colleagues did just this, investigating the microbiomes of twins to see how their genetic similarities influenced the species they carried. The scientists collected stool samples from 1,126 pairs of twins and cataloged the microbial inhabitants. Out of thousands of species of bacteria, they identified 20 that were more strongly correlated in identical twins than in fraternal ones. In other words, if one identical twin carried a particular species, the other twin was more likely to carry it too. The scientists found that some species were more heritable than others. The most heritable of all was a kind called Christensenella. Goodrich and her colleagues estimated its heritability at around 40%. That's on par with moderately heritable traits, such as anxiety. These results suggested that the genes we inherit from our parents help determine which microbes we end up harboring. To investigate this possibility further, Goodrich and her colleagues took a different approach. They scanned people's genomes, looking for people who shared certain variants and certain kinds of bacteria. They discovered that people with one variant have a high population of microbes belonging to a group of species called bifidobacteria. The nature of that genetic variation hints at why it favors bifidobacteria. It controls a gene for a protein we use to break down a sugar called lactose. Babies make lots of this protein, called lactase, to break down the lactose in breast milk. The majority of children stop making lactase as they shift to eating solid food, but others have a different genetic variant that lets them continue making lactase, allowing them to digest milk sugar into adulthood. Bifidobacteria thrives on the lactose that doesn't get digested by the time it reaches the large intestine. People who can take it up tend to have fewer bifidobacteria, but those who shut down their lactase wind up feeding a bigger population of microbes. It's not so clear why Christensenella, the most heritable bacteria of Goodrich's study, is heritable. Perhaps that mystery has something to do with the fact that the microbe was only discovered in 2012. Scientists have determined that Christensenella breaks down a variety of sugars, and other types of bacteria feed on its byproducts. There are hints that Christensenella acts like a gatekeeper, helping to control how much of the energy in our food actually gets to our body instead of to our microbiome. One clue comes from looking at who carries Christensenella and who doesn't. Lean people are more likely to carry it than overweight ones. Another clue emerged from an experiment Goodrich and her colleagues ran on mice. They infected baby mice with Christensenella and then waited for them to grow to adulthood on a regular diet. The bacteria left the animals slim. Mice without Christensenella put on 15% more weight and ended up with 25% body fat. Mice with Christensenella gained only 10% more weight and reached 21% body fat. These findings raise the possibility that we have to take the microbiome into account to understand why a trait such as weight is heritable. Some of the genetic variants behind the heritability of weight may not directly influence how our cells store fat. Instead, we inherit a variant that fosters Christensenella in our guts. It's the bacteria that take it from there. There is one species of bacteria that has merged snugly into our bodies, even more snugly than the microbes that give the flashlight fish its light. This microbe has actually merged into our heredity, becoming such an intimate part of our existence that for decades many scientists refused to believe it started out as a free-living organism. I'm speaking of mitochondria, the tiny pouches that produce fuel inside our cells. Mitochondria first came to the attention of biologists in the late 1800s as they developed new chemicals for staining the interior of cells. The stains revealed that the cells of animals were packed with mysterious granules. A German biologist named Richard Altman published an entire book on these strange objects, filled with loving drawings of extraordinary accuracy. Altman was astonished by how much the granules looked like bacteria. Not only were they shaped like bacteria, but sometimes Altman's stains revealed them dividing in two like bacteria. Altman developed an obsessive conviction that these granules were alive. He called them elementary organisms. Altman believed that cells themselves came into existence when these granules assembled into colonies and built a shelter of protoplasm around themselves. The idea sounded absurd to other biologists. They rejected it so completely that Altman turned into a bitter recluse. He would slip in and out of his lab through a back door, avoiding all human contact. His colleagues began referring to him as the ghost. In 1900, Altman died under mysterious circumstances at age 48. Things went from bad to worse, the biologist Edmund Cowdery wrote cryptically in a 1953 History of Mitochondrial Research, and the end was tragic and of the sort expected. Cowdery forgave Altman his error about mitochondria, for the similarities between them and bacteria really are remarkable, he said. Ultimately, though, Cowdery and most other researchers judged the similarities only superficial. Mitochondria were simply parts of the cell, their construction encoded by the cell's own genes. Years of subsequent research revealed that mitochondria performed an essential job. They use oxygen and sugar to create a cell's fuel supply. Researchers also discovered that mitochondria were shared not only by all animals, but also by plants, fungi, and protozoans. In other words, by all eukaryotes. Tracing these lineages on the tree of life revealed that mitochondria must have evolved in the common ancestor of eukaryotes some 1.8 billion years ago. In the early 1960s, an astonishing fact about mitochondria came to light. They contain more than just proteins. Scientists also discovered they store their own DNA, if only a little. Human mitochondria have only 37 genes, compared to about 20,000 protein-coding genes in the nucleus. Nevertheless, the discovery of mitochondrial DNA baffled scientists. Our cells have many compartments, lysosomes for breaking down food molecules, for example, and the endoplasmic reticulum for moving proteins around the cell. But of them all, only mitochondria have their own set of genes. Lynn Margulis, a biologist at the University of Massachusetts, argued that there was only one way to make sense of the discovery. It was time to revisit the old theories of Altman and other early cell biologists. The evidence pointed to mitochondria starting out as free-living bacteria and still holding on to a few of their original genes. Margulis would be proven right. Starting in the 1970s, scientists began sequencing mitochondrial DNA. When they looked for the most similar genes in other species, they found that mitochondria most resembled bacteria. They were even able to narrow the genetic resemblance down to one lineage in particular, a group of species called alpha proteobacteria. Before gaining their mitochondria, the evidence now suggests, our ancestors were microbes that survived by slurping some kind of molecular debris from their surroundings. About 1.8 billion years ago, a small species of bacteria, an alpha proteobacteria to be specific, ended up permanently inside of them. Living alpha proteobacteria have given scientists inspiration for ideas about how this merger happened. Some researchers have argued that the alpha proteobacteria slipped into the larger cells as parasites. Their host did their best to destroy the invaders, but the alpha proteobacteria evolved defenses. In time, they stopped spreading from cell to cell. When their host divided, the alpha proteobacteria wound up in both the daughter cells. Other scientists have proposed that the two microbes lived side by side at first. They traded essential nutrients, helping each other thrive. The closer they were to their partners, the more reliably they could exchange these gifts. Eventually, they merged entirely. Whichever is the case, gaining mitochondria marked one of the great leaps in the evolution of life. A cell now could harvest the fuel made by its new lodgers. The more mitochondria a cell could house, the more energy it could use. This symbiosis spiraled upward, allowing eukaryote cells to become far bigger, far more complex than any cell before. Instead of feeding on molecular debris, eukaryotes now had enough fuel to chase after bacteria and engulf them. Later, these single-celled predators began clinging together, evolving into multicellular creatures. Ensconced in their new home, mitochondria followed the same path that endosymbionts so often do. They abandoned many of the genes they had once needed to live freely on their own. Yet mitochondria never gave up their own form of heredity. Altman might have been wrong to think that mitochondria were independent life forms, but he was right to think of bacteria when he saw mitochondria dividing. Within a cell, a mitochondrion will sometimes split in two, and the daughter mitochondria inherit copies of its DNA, just as their free-living ancestors did nearly 2 billion years ago. When our own cells divide, their daughter cells inherit a portion of their mitochondria, which keep dividing over the course of our lifetime. Our bodies don't get overrun by mitochondria because our cells sometimes destroy them, keeping their numbers in check. Our deaths bring an end to the lineages of mitochondria in our bodies. The only ones with a chance to escape to the future are those that dwell in women's eggs. A man's mitochondria have no future because their sperm destroy them during fertilization. The fact that mitochondria are inherited only down the maternal line makes their DNA a powerful genealogical tool. It allowed some scientists to reunite the family of the Tsar Nicholas. It allowed others to reunite all living humans, tracing our mitochondrial DNA to a single woman in Africa 150,000 years ago. Yet mitochondria's distinctive patterns of heredity have also created deep confusion. When mitochondria copy their DNA, they can make mistakes and introduce mutations. Some of those mutations can disrupt their fuel-generating assembly line, while others can cause devastating hereditary diseases. They can make eyes go blind, ears go deaf, muscles waste away. Many of these mitochondrial diseases went overlooked for decades by geneticists because they flouted Mendel's law. In some families, a disease will only sporadically strike relatives over the generations. In other families, the same disease will reliably occur in every child of a mutation-carrying mother. It wasn't until the late 1980s that scientists began pinpointing the genetic basis of mitochondrial diseases. Since then, they've identified hundreds of these disorders, which together afflict 1 in 4,000 people. Strangely, though, these people often have relatives who carry the same mutations in their mitochondria, but don't suffer the same symptoms. This confusion dissolves when you bear in mind that mitochondria are our resident bacteria, following their own rules of heredity. If a single mitochondrion mutates, the cell that carries it will continue functioning normally, because it still has hundreds of other healthy ones. When the cell divides, one of its daughter cells inherits that one mutant mitochondrion. As the mutant mitochondrion itself divides, it becomes a bigger burden on cells. When the number of mutant mitochondria rises above a certain threshold, a cell will start to fail. Mutant mitochondria can continue to become more common from one generation to the next. A woman with low levels of mutant mitochondria may give birth to children who cross the threshold into a full-blown mitochondrial disease. Thanks to chance, some of her children may get sick, while others remain healthy. Studying mitochondrial diseases may eventually lead scientists to an answer to the biggest question about their heredity. Why does it follow only the maternal line? We all need mitochondria, males and females alike, to stay alive. Sperm need mitochondria to power their swim toward conception. Scientists have discovered a few species in which both parents pass down their mitochondria to their offspring. Ink cap mushrooms are one. Geraniums are another. In mussels, sons inherit mitochondria from both parents, while daughters inherit them only from their mothers. But in the overwhelming majority of species, fathers never pass down their mitochondria. All these clues hint that there must be some powerful advantage to limiting mitochondria to the maternal line. It's possible that this kind of heredity evolves because mixing together mitochondria from two parents can be a disaster for children. In 2012, Douglas Wallace, an expert on mitochondrial diseases at the University of Pennsylvania and